From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Things work differently in China. From more than 1.3 billion people, just 25 ascend to the Communist Party's Politburo, and they pick the president behind closed doors. That's it. No ads on TV, no lines at voting stations. Last week, 59-year-old party man Xi Jinping was chosen to run China for the next decade. His to-do list is long: fight corruption, modernize China's economy, maybe hip-check a U.S. rebalancing toward Asia. Meanwhile, President Obama has been in Asia this week trying to do just that. This hour on Point, the new leadership in Beijing and what it means for China, the U.S., and the world. You can join the conversation after our 2 years of campaigning. What do you make of China's two-week snap of the fingers to pick a new leader? Where do you think he'll lead? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll look at the news from Beijing in a moment, but first to China's southern flank, Southeast Asia, where President Obama has been this week. Hans Nichols is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. He joins us from Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where the president's just been after Thailand and Myanmar, Burma. Hans Nichols, welcome. Is the president in the air on his way back home?
Tom, thanks for having me. The president is in the air. He left Tuesday afternoon, evening, and so he'll get back in time to pardon the Thanksgiving turkey.
So what's his team thinking? Did they make a big, great impression in Southeast Asia? Does the White House think he accomplished what he set out to do?
In Burma, most certainly. You know, you have to think of this trip in three parts. Think of it as the Burma-Myanmar component. Think of it also in terms of the larger institutional Southeast Asian structures. A little weaker report there than what the White House probably wanted. And then the third component has to be the Middle East and how the White House was managing the conflict between Israel and Hamas from afar. And at the very end, the president dispatched Hillary Clinton to fly directly to Israel.
Hello, Hans, have we got you? Oh. Well, it looks like we lost Hans at the airport in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, but we're happy to have had him for a minute there anyways. The president wraps up this tour of Myanmar, Burma, of Thailand. We saw him there touring temples, big Buddhas and all the rest, and in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where the Association of Southeast Asian Nations had leadership meetings going on this week. And we've heard the Chinese outgoing Prime Minister or Wen Jiabao talking from there. I've got a little tape here. Even when the president was in Myanmar at the University of Yangon on Monday, you can hear him looking over his shoulder at the big neighbor of Burma to the north, China.
I came here because of the importance of your country. You live at the crossroads of East and South Asia. You border the most populated nations on the planet. You have a history that reaches back thousands of years and the ability to help determine the destiny of the fastest growing region of the world.
The most populated nations in the planet, neighbors of Myanmar, India to its west and to its north, China, with a big eye on Myanmar, Burma. In Cambodia, the president spoke again about China as he met with Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao at the East Asia Summit in Phnom Penh, calling for greater cooperation between the U.S. and China.
It is very important that as two of the largest economies in the world, that we work to establish clear rules of the road internationally for trade and investment, which can increase prosperity and global growth.
And who will he be cooperating with if it works that way? Last Thursday in Beijing, the new seven-member standing committee of the Chinese Communist Party's Politburo were announced to the world. Here's a reporter there from Al Jazeera describing the scene, then the new leader, Xi Jinping.
The new Chinese leaders revealed, led by President-in-waiting Xi Jinping. The seven men file onto a stage in the Great Hall of the People. And it's the will of the people, says Xi Jinping in his first public address as party secretary, that the leaders must take into account.
We want our children to grow up well and have better jobs and more fulfilling lives. The people's desire for a better life is what we shall fight for.
The new president in waiting, Xi Jinping, there speaking at the end of that report from Beijing just last week as the new leadership was announced. Joining me now from San Diego, Susan Shirk. From 1997 till 2000, she was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, responsibility for U.S. relations with China. She's now at the University of California, San Diego, where she chairs the 21st Century China Program. Susan Shirk, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much.
And from Washington, Damian Ma joins us. He's an analyst with the Eurasia Group, a political risk analysis group. He also writes about China for The Atlantic. Damian Ma, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
Damian, give us a sense first of how the Chinese people themselves have received the news of their new leader handed down to them by the standing committee there. What do they make of Xi Jinping?
Well, first of all, I would say the majority of the Chinese population probably wasn't paying that much attention. But for the, you know, for the small minority that did pay attention, I was, I think, struck by the instant the way in which the Chinese public felt, you know, Xi Jinping was more likable than Hu Jintao. Now, to be fair, that's not a high bar to cross. But I think it is important to know that perhaps this leader is more likable for the Chinese public themselves, and that could potentially have an impact on how he governs in China.
You followed comments online as this announcement was made and some of the things people had to say there. What were they saying in the online comments that you followed about the new leader, Xi Jinping?
Well, I think for the most part, they liked the fact that he didn't dwell on the usual, you know, muddled theoretical party, official Communist Party speak. He didn't do that kind of rhetoric. He basically talked about what the Chinese want, you know, sort of the Chinese dream, growing incomes, healthcare, a better life, happiness, those types of things that I think even Western politicians would find, you know, to have in common.
And likability, what does that mean in China? What does it mean exactly?
Well, I think there is perhaps a slight correlation between likability and also the fact that that Xi Jinping himself is so-called a princeling. He comes from a powerful political family. That may confer upon him a bit more legitimacy than what happened to President Hu Jintao. So I think those two things combined perhaps may, and obviously it's early days, but it may give Xi Jinping a bit more flexibility to govern.
He didn't come out with party speak, that kind of stilted, staid old language. He spoke directly to people's interests. You quote people saying here. And that just his sort of physical presence, kind of a big guy, baritone voice, and in contrast to his predecessor, feels pretty warm, Damian.
He does. He did come across as such. But, you know, we should also understand that Xi Jinping is also a nationalist, like most Chinese leaders are. I probably consider him a liberal nationalist. He probably believes in certain domestic reforms, but he also is, I think, most likely going to want to defend China's interests. And I think in a way that perhaps was even more than Hu Jintao did because of, you know, China's growing strength. So, you know, he is friendly. He comes off as a normal guy. And I think there was a lot of craving in China for someone who was more normal than the stilted politician that we saw for the last 10 years. So I think in that sense, it is a positive projection of image at the outset.
Xi Jinping, the newly selected Chinese president that Damian writes, may be the princeling president who one could conceivably have a beer with, not like some who've gone before. Susan Shirk, you were watching this closely in the weeks and days up to the announcement, and now we've seen it. What were you looking for as the committee sat down to make its choice?
Well, I was interested to see whether or not the politicos in the smoke-filled room would be able to agree on who should get into the very top collective leadership, which is the standing committee of the Politburo. Mm-hmm. Used to be 9 people, now it's 7 people. We can talk about why that matters. But what it means is that the pyramid's really very narrow at the top, and there's intense competition. And I was wondering whether or not they would be able to pull it off. And if they didn't, they might have to change the way they choose the leaders. Because, of course, this smoke-filled room method stands in sharp contrast with all their rhetoric about intra-party democracy.
I mean, one of the interesting things here is that while we sort of parse what our candidates for leadership have to say for weeks, months, years before they take the top office, you and others write, Susan, that in this path to power, some of the most effective leaders are those who do not get tied to public positions much at all.
I think that's true, because they want organization men who are loyal. I say men advisedly because...
Nearly all.
Because women have a very tough time making it up in Chinese politics. So they want people who will not rock the boat. And they saw just in the past few months with a leader, Bo Xilai, who tried to change the rules of the game to campaign openly for office by using this new, more open media environment to develop a popular following. They do not want that. They want people who will keep a low profile and make it appear to the public that everyone at the top agrees with everyone else. There are no splits, no differences.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's big leadership change and what it may mean for China, the U.S., the world. Damian Ma joins us from Washington with the Eurasia Group, writes a monthly column on China for The Atlantic. Susan Shirk is with us from San Diego. She's been right in the U.S. State Department, working very closely on this in the late 90s, on the China relationship. Now she's at the University of California, San Diego, and still right in the middle of it. Her 2008 book is China, Fragile Superpower. 2010, Changing Media, Changing China. Here was the outgoing president, Hu Jintao, opening the party congress that ended up pointing to Xi Jinping as the next leader, calling here for economic and legal reforms.
We must ensure that all kinds of economic entities can use production resources fairly and in accordance with the law, are able to engage in market competition, and are protected legally in an equitable manner. We must improve the current economic structures, accelerate fiscal reform, and further financial reforms.
Fairness, competition, legal equity, all of those really open issues in China. Last Thursday, after Xi Jinping was announced as the successor to Hu Jintao there, people flocked in the streets of Beijing to watch live footage of the party congress underway. The BBC spoke with a couple of those about their hopes for the new administration.
We're very satisfied with the new leadership lineup we just saw. We can rest assured now, and more importantly, we have high expectations for the new leadership.
We hope the new leaders can lead the Chinese people to a moderately prosperous society by 2020, so the ordinary people like us can enjoy the real benefits brought about our country's prosperity and strength.
Damian Ma, okay, the BBC takes its microphones to the streets of Beijing to ask about the new selection, and the first guy says, "We're very satisfied." Just give us a gut check these days. Could that man say something else without fear of, I don't know, some consequences? How open is China? How free do the Chinese feel to talk frankly about their leadership?
Well, first of all, what they say, I think, is a bit different from what I've heard the last few times I've been through China and talking to folks in Beijing. I actually think there is a heightened level of anxiety and concern over the new leadership and the direction of their country. I think both on the economic front and also on a political front. And I think the new leadership, no matter who it was, now to Xi Jinping has a very full plate in front of them. So I would characterize it more in terms of anxiety mm-hmm. and concern rather than just overwhelming adulation for the new leadership.
What's the anxiety? What's the concern, Damian?
I think after 30, 35 years of reform, there's, I think, increasingly this sense of reform fatigue. There is lack of there's not much of a roadmap or blueprint of how to really go forward. They have a 12-5-year plan on changing the structure of the economy, but they don't really quite know how to execute it. And so I think there's a bit of a trepidation over exactly how to hold this thing together going forward. And I think the biggest change is what you talked about, which is domestic politics has changed. And I think they're operating in a very information-intensive environment, which has never really happened to the Communist Party before. So that's a huge challenge for the party.
That is the internet media, more media than ever. Susan Shirk, you've written a lot about that. You wrote in the days before this decision, Susan, that the question is not just who would fill the top post until 2022, a couple of five-year terms have become the norm there, though all this is very recent for China. I mean, they just had their first peaceful transfer of power in history 10 years ago. But you said 10 years from now, there's a real open question about whether the Communist Party itself will still rule China. Where do you see that trending, given how this party Congress turned out, Susan?
Well, they certainly have bought themselves a bit more time because they used a seniority rule to decide who would get promoted to the standing committee. So they managed to prevent any serious splits in the leadership this time around by having the older leaders move up and promising the younger ones that they could get promoted next time. Actually, they're going to do that in 5 years.
Now help us understand. You're saying that's important because if they hadn't managed to hang it on seniority, they could have had a kind of all-out tong war.
Power struggle.
And those can be very, very real inside this relatively
small
circle.
We've seen some pretty ugly power struggles in China in the past, especially in the Mao era and following the Mao era. And the leaders of China know full well that authoritarian regimes like China's usually fall top down, not bottom up.
Meaning they split from the top. They crack up
exactly.
at the top.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, we're all focused on the increasing incidence of protests, social unrest, which certainly is more than in the past, but it's hard to know how to evaluate that. You know, we get these statistics. China's a big country. Most of those protests are pretty small scale and localized. So China's leaders are very nervous about them, but they might be more nervous than they need to be. You know, hard to say. But what they are also very nervous about is preventing any open divisions at the top. And these moments of transition are the most difficult from that respect. They managed to pull this one off.
You wrote about how Tiananmen and the chaos we saw there was in no small part a reflection of splits in the top of the party then in 1989.
That's right. That's why there were demonstrations in more than 130 cities throughout China over an extended period, and the leadership split over how to respond, and that's what brought the government really to the brink of collapse. And of course, that's the same year the Berlin Wall fell and all the communist governments in Europe started falling. So ever since that time, China's leaders have been very worried that their own days in power are numbered.
Who are these guys, mainly guys, as you say, at the top of this very steep pyramid? Where do they come from and what are their portfolios, Susan?
Well, they've made their careers mostly by being local leaders and then moving up to be provincial leaders. A high proportion of them this time around are from families, red families, families in which their fathers or fathers-in-law were old cadres in the revolution, and those connections have definitely helped them move up. Then they made their way up the ladder, and most of them have been provincial party secretaries, which is an executive position, much like our governors. We liked governors for presidents, too, because they've run their own government. They've run something. They've had to manage all the different interest groups. So, and they have learned to talk to people. Now, in China, of course, those governors are not elected. They're appointed from above. So few of them have the common touch, you might say, although I agree with Damien that Xi Jinping's initial style in speaking in his first speech was definitely different than in the past.
Susan, you were looking closely at this, the Standing Committee of the Politburo, and who would be on it, who wouldn't, but also what portfolios they represented. It's been cut down from 9 to 7. You said, watch out to see if internal security is still on this tight inner circle that meets once a week to kind of steer the country. Watch out to see if the propaganda portfolio, propaganda and media control is still on this tip-top body. Are they still there or gone, Susan?
50%. The security portfolio, the internal security police, the secret police, that are in charge of maintaining order and keeping the party in power, that portfolio has been demoted down to a lower level, to the Politburo level, where it will be led by the Minister of Public Security.
Okay.
That's good news. That's very good news.
Because it's less power for the kind of what the internal security.
The police state, exactly.
Right.
So the police state, which a lot of people have been very critical that it's gotten out of control. Nobody's saying no to it. It is getting bigger and more powerful and more corrupt, by the way.
But the propaganda guys are still in there, the ones who you say really damaged the credibility of the government in the last decade?
Yes, they are. And I'm disappointed in that, and I'm sure my journalist friends in China are also disappointed about that.
Damien, what does that say to you about openness in China in the decade ahead? Is the big clamp still on? I mean, they have a massive censorship operation, as Susan writes, and you know well. Does that mean it's still on?
I believe it will continue to be on. If anything, it could possibly be even ramped up given, as Susan said, the propaganda department, the guy who's running it, is also, I think, likely going to get the vice presidency spot. So I think, you know, they need to I think they're really trying to figure out how to deal with social media, how to deal with bottom-up information channels that are not part of the party apparatus. And so, you know, you've created a sort of a semi-autonomous public sphere among, you know, Chinese elites that are on social media, the internet, and so on. Yes, you can censor it. Yes, you can clamp it down. But, you know, it's porous. And so I think they're really struggling with how to control those aspects. And I think perhaps the elevation of propaganda again is you know, trying to lay out a new strategy in dealing with that.
We're going to look at how all this may hit the economy there or change it, relations with the U.S., the military, the world. Alex is calling from Boston. Alex, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I'm a businessman. I own my own business. I've worked in China for over 20 years now, and in various different capacities.
Yeah.
And anyways, been in several provinces in the south, Guangdong, Fujian.
What have you seen, Alex?
I've seen a lot of, it's very interesting. I've worked a lot in factories. The factory workers, when I first got there, they all wore basically Mao suits. They were in uniform. 10 years later, they're all dressing in jeans, designer jeans, and all with makeup and looking very, you know. So it's the people, and they're great workers. I mean, I respect the Chinese. They've invented capitalism. They are, I know they're longing to become more informed about what's going on in the world. We never really have these conversations because I'm very respectful of them and not putting them in any compromised position. But they, I can just tell, and I've become friends with a lot, that they want more of the openness that the censored government is not allowing. And it could be very peaceful if they, if the Chinese government were able, they could allow this to happen, and they'd have to become a democracy of some sort. But the Chinese don't want to, I have the feeling, they don't want a major revolution like Tiananmen Square could have turned out to be. It got squashed. I watched that from Thailand when I lived in Bangkok. But
yeah, Alex, let us pick it up right there because you raised this big question that my guests already point to. But let's bring the circle around here. I mean, Susan, what about this choice, this power handover, and the issue of openness, or as Americans might say, freedom? Do you see it as more or less likely in this next 10 years? Can you read these tea leaves in one direction or another?
Well, I think the leadership may continue to be divided about how much openness to allow. Certainly, the obvious hand of the censor on the internet is very transparent and is very frustrating to people. People, young people especially, who are the ones, of course, who could take to the street, as they have in other authoritarian countries, they are very upset, resentful at being treated as children who can't have access to information. And I speculate that the people's right to know could become a rallying cry for the next Chinese revolution.
I mean, what you also raise this question, which is kind of stark to see, but the question of whether 10 years from now the Communist Party itself will still rule China. I mean, our caller says, you know, give them openness and you'll be on some path to democracy, though it may He doesn't think people want revolution there. Well, sure, they want. I mean, most people just want to get along. But what's the path that would lead the Communist Party, so big and powerful and rich, to lose that grip?
Well, we
on power?
Have we have precedents of in Taiwan, in South Korea.
Not of communists in those, but
no,
of
not communists,
authoritarian.
That's right. And actually, the Kuomintang in Taiwan and the Chinese Communist Party mm-hmm. were very similar in structure. And, you know, I think the next generation of leaders here who've just come to power, they really do have the opportunity to lead a peaceful transition to a more open and at least somewhat democratic system. If they'd have to do three things to really lay a foundation for mm-hmm. a stable democracy. The lowest hanging fruit is the legal system. They're already committed rhetorically, normatively, to rule of law. But the courts are still dominated by party
it's subverted
party
all the
bodies.
Time. Yeah.
That's right. The second thing, of course, is freedom of the press. And here again, they talk a lot about it, and China is much more open than it used to be, but still there is this visible hand of the censor.
Sure.
And the third thing is civil society, non-governmental organizations. And if they were
they're
to—
They're very suspicious of those.
They're suspicious, but they also need them to help blow the whistle on corrupt local officials and other problems going on at a local level in order to fix them. So I think that there are many people in China who believe that the party could gradually do more in these three areas, which would lay the foundation for a stable democracy in China at a later point.
Damian Ma, do you see Xi Jinping and the half dozen around him now as more open than the outgoing leadership to those kind of reforms?
I think it's very hard to say. I don't see any. I don't see any clear signs that they would be more tolerant or more open. But I. Mm-hmm. But I certainly don't agree with Susan that the choice the party faces is pretty stark. It's between adaptation or you know remaining stagnant. And I think the party has adapted quite some, you know, quite well for the last 35 years. And I think now, as I was saying before, one of the biggest challenges is can the system adapt to rising middle class expectations, which is not about really democracy, but it is about the sorts of individual freedoms, openness that I think people do actually crave more than they did, you know, 10 years ago. And that frankly, is not an area in which the system, the current system, deals well with.
And where we've just seen in the last few weeks these reports of Wen Jiabao, the prime minister there, his family having assets of $2.7 billion. Talk about equitable. I mean, you know, coming up from sort of working class to that hardly sounds like, well, we'll come back and look at that. Xi Jinping talking about corruption already. China not happy with those reports in the Times. But nevertheless, there they are. Damian Ma, please stand by in Washington. Susan Shirk in San Diego. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about China's big leadership change and what it may mean for China, the U.S., the world. During the announcement of his new status as incoming president of China, this was last Thursday, Xi Jinping railed against corruption.
In the new environment, our party faces many severe challenges, and there are many pressing problems within the party that need to be resolved. The problems among our party members and cadres of corruption, taking bribes, being out of touch with the people, undue emphasis on formalities and bureaucratism must be addressed with great efforts. The whole party must be vigilant against them.
The incoming Xi Jinping, he said it right there on Thursday. He's said it again and very prominently in the days since. We'll talk about what that might mean. Corruption, a big deal in China. Susan Shirk is with us from the University of California, San Diego, author of China, Fragile Superpower, Changing Media, Changing China. Damian Ma's with us from the Eurasia Group, writes for The Atlantic on China. Let's go to Bo in Windsor, Connecticut. Bo, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Want to point out two things. You were talking about how these leaders are elected. Actually, you know, Chinese politics is very different than the U.S. What people do is they watch for years and see who appears at certain events.
Right.
Who meets with foreign dignitaries and who goes to the disaster areas. And actually, before these leaders came in public, people have known that they're going to be there. They're going to be the next leaders for years, for a couple years at least.
Bo, are you Chinese? Are you mainland Chinese?
Yes, I came from China 26 years ago, and I go back every year, travel back. So I watch carefully. And, you know, for as far as the corruption is concerned, you know, Xi Jinping himself is not very clean, I don't believe. All of them have already gotten enough. Now they're talking very seriously about, you know, fighting corruption. That means it's time to stop. This time we're serious because you have taken plenty
from
the people.
Get the ladle out of the pot, please. Bo, I appreciate your call. Susan, we've heard Xi Jinping say again, I think it was just today out of China, that this has to stop. There's been so much. Bo comes from China. She says they've got enough. They don't need it anymore. But we all know how that works. There's always somebody new, somebody who wants their piece or another piece. I mean, how does China, Xi Jinping, really stop this deep engagement of Chinese Communist Party players in the economy? They're so intertwined.
Mm. Well, that's true. The source of corruption is the government regulation of the economy and the fact that you have to get approvals to do so many things, even to, you know, say to list your firm on the stock market, to get a certain amount of foreign investment.
Lots of moments to put the squeeze on very easily.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. So what most Chinese economists would say is that we need to reduce the state role in the economy, which, of course, is what Deng Xiaoping was trying to do with the market reforms that were introduced in the 1980s. And much of Chinese growth today really is the result of that big takeoff that came in the 80s when you ended central planning and created a market economy.
But didn't boot the party out. It just made a lot of them rich.
Exactly. And since the late 90s, the state-owned enterprises and the state bureaucracies have reasserted control. And those big enterprises, those big companies, are very well connected, and they get all sorts of subsidized credit and land. So they've become profitable, but profitable in an environment that is rigged for them and against private enterprise. Keep your eye on private business in China today. That really will be the test of this new leadership. Are they really willing to give the private entrepreneurs a fair shake? And I think otherwise private business will not play the role that it could play in boosting Chinese growth. And you see more and more people starting to put their savings, their investment capital outside of China in order to hedge their bets. Capital flight has become a serious problem.
That'll get any country's attention. I mean, Damian Ma, speaking
exactly.
of social media, we've got here writing on our Facebook page, Gary says, China is tragicomic. It is backdoor capitalism in a backwards totalitarian society. Says the Chinese people are wonderful, so are the Tibetans, he writes. But China's public leadership is a corrupt anachronism. Well, that may be true, but is there something unsustainable in this next decade? When Xi Jinping raises that alarm so high, does he see something unsustainable here, Damian?
Well, I think most people would agree that that the priority, the top concern, is this growing social inequality. And part of that has to do with the systemic corruption that's really spreading in China right now. I think the fundamental question on corruption, on tackling corruption, is whether the party itself would be willing to be subject to the rule of law. Now, as long as they're not willing to, and the status quo holds, then you're really not going to get any fundamental changes, but just, you know, tweaking at the margins. And a second point here is on corruption under the new administration, the man to watch is this guy named Wang Qishan, who was a vice premier. He got promoted to the standing committee. He was supposed to get the economic portfolio, but he didn't. He ended up running the internal anti-corruption body. He is actually well known to Americans in Washington. He used to lead the Chinese part of the bilateral dialogue with Washington and Beijing. Mm-hmm. So he won't be doing that anymore, but he's running the anti-corruption body. There are two interpretations, basically. One is that he himself is a princeling, so maybe he got sent there to protect princelings but go after everyone else.
Oh, boy.
The other interpretation is that he is, he is known as a competent, blunt, straight shooter kind of guy, so maybe he is sent there to really clean house a little bit more. Now, I can't say which one's more likely. I say it's 50-50, but I think those are the sort of, two interpretations right now.
Wang Shichun, man to watch. Let's get a few calls in here. Brian from Lexington, Kentucky. Brian, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just got a quick comment. Comment is, what about the generational gap? You know, you've kind of got the old guard at the top, and like you were saying earlier, I mean, these guys, and they've been not only generationally trained, and they've lived this their whole life. This is the way that their government has been ran. So that's their core belief. It seems like with the younger generation and this and the new guy they've got in there now, is the generational gap going to play any part in this, or is the regime just so tight, on everything?
Brian will raise that. Xi Jinping, 59 years old. On the other hand, he's a princeling. He comes right out of that line of descent, but we'll look at it. Let me hold that one. Matt in Buffalo, New York. Matt, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering if any of the guests would think that any part of the split in the party have to do with, people who still believe in some sort of ideal, of communism. Maybe I'm looking at it more in the positive sense of the word, universal brotherhood, equality, a different way of doing business other than just commerce. And if maybe, and I'm specifically looking at that official recently who, him and his wife were, came into some trouble for like murder charges.
Bo Xila, yeah.
And he was one of the people who was, really cracking down on mafia, and he was bringing back some of the old Maoist songs. And I just find it a little suspicious that somebody who's doing those kind of activities, is the one who they go after. So that's what I'm wondering, if any of the guests think there's any split between, true believers and people who are just kind of there for
money,
their own
money, powerful. We'll pick that one up as well. And one more, then we'll do it. Mackenzie in Manchester, Connecticut. Mackenzie, you're on.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I go to China quite a bit every month, to be exact. And I was there last week during our elections, which was interesting, seeing, Romney and Obama, all the things that were going on.
Sure.
And they're asking me about voting, and I was talking about that. And then they said, well, hey, at least, you're getting a new president, too, and pretty soon in a couple of weeks. And they just looked down to it, and they looked at me, and they go, well, at least you get to vote. So they were, jealous is probably too strong of a word, but they were wishing that they could vote. And
Mackenzie, what kind of people, what kind of Chinese were these? Were they factory workers? Were they management? Were they party members who wanted to vote, who were envious of that?
I would say all of that. There was mostly people who I work with are in the IT software business, and even the sponsors who are higher up, the CEOs were saying things like that. So I was kind of surprised. I did hear it from a lot of the 20 to 30-year-olds. But I did also hear from higher managers, too, that they wish they could vote.
Well, we'll do that as well. Our callers are great. Let's pick them up one by one. Brian here, Damien. Brian says, what about generational change? Is there a generational change bubbling along here, or does the younger generation of princelings just say, no, our parents had the power, maybe our grandparents, we want the power too?
Well, I think as Susan said before, there are only two people under 60, and the rest are sort of the old guard that made it into the standing committee this time. So the two younger supposed reformers from Guangdong, Wang Yang, and the other guy, Li Yuanqiao, they did not make it this time. So I think we're going to have to wait, five more years until 2017 to see what happens then.
But when they come, do you presume that they come with a different agenda from their elders?
That is the hope. They've lived through a different period of China, mostly through reform and opening up. I think they have they're known to not only back economic economic reforms, they also think more, you know, more strategically about political reform. So there's potentially some more hope on that front.
Susan, this Matt calls from Buffalo and wants to know if they're still true believers in sort of, you know, high communist ideals of brotherhood, sisterhood, equality. And is there tension between some of that and the let's get rich quick crowd? What about it?
Yes. In fact, Borsilai had quite a few followers, especially in Chongqing, where he was very popular for his law and order neo-Maoism, you might say,
right,
which is an interesting combination.
Yes.
And populism, right? He also had a target for inequality, narrowing inequality, which may, in fact, get adopted at a national level. But yes, there are true believers, but I think it's really a yearning to believe in something, because nowadays there's such widespread cynicism at every level, as many of the callers and Damien have also noted. And people are searching for something good, something to believe in. And Maoist ideals, although, of course, they were not realized in practice, it was a pretty terrible society to live in. But some of those ideals are still quite inspirational, you might say. And what else do we have? Because the liberals believe in something they call universal values, the values of human rights and freedom.
Are they a real voice in China, in the party leadership?
Well, you know, I don't think you see any in the standing committee today, but certainly many of their advisors, many of the economic technocrats who believe in the market also believe in those liberal values.
So maybe something there. And Damien, what about Mackenzie's report that she's been in China very recently during our voting here and talk to Chinese envious of the American vote for their president? Does that surprise you? Does that portend some change in a democratic direction, or just wishful thinking?
No, that doesn't really surprise me. If you tracked, you know, the 20 to 40 year old cohort who are mostly on the Chinese Weibo, which is the Chinese version of Twitter, the U.S. election, I believe, was the number one and number two highest trending topics during those few days, not the Chinese transition, but the U.S. election. And I think there is some, you know, there's a bit of a bottom-up craving for maybe we should have some changes here, that we should have more of a say, that we should have more equity in our own political system. I think the Chinese really like to contrast and compare other countries to their own countries. And I think one instance, again, that happened, you know, I think a few years ago was comparing U.S. Ambassador Gary Locke to their own politicians.
He was out and about humbly without a big entourage. Yep.
Exactly. These things happen all the time. And frankly, that is a problem with social media, is that people can see more clearly the differences and they can say what's good, what's bad, and you know, how we need to change domestically.
Well, it's really fascinating. And then let's go to U.S.-China. I've just got a few minutes, but there was our president on China's southern flank. We heard him on tape talking cooperation, not confrontation. On the other hand, he's sort of in China's face, getting right up there cozy with its immediate neighbors. Susan, do you see with Xi Jinping an open mind toward a more collaborative relationship with the United States, or a presumption of confrontation?
Well, up until a few years ago, China was working very hard to prevent a Cold War with the United States. Because our economies are so interdependent, because a confrontation with the much more powerful United States would really sharply interrupt China's economic development, its rise as a global power. It, you know, it kept its head down and really tried to show a benign, responsible face to the world, especially to the United States. After the global financial crisis, things started to change. Because in China, as in other countries, there has been a perception that the U.S. is on the decline and that China is on the rise. And that created a demand for a more assertive foreign policy. But I believe that China's leaders very well understand that it would be suicidal for China to try to confront the United States in Asia at this point in time. There's no sign that they're trying to push the U.S. out of the region. They're certainly somewhat uneasy with our heightened presence in the region, but I believe that they'll be pretty pragmatic and try to accommodate to that and make themselves more appealing friends to their own neighbors.
Well, that's a hopeful note, but I don't know, with all the tension at sea over the South China Sea and the little islands and all the rest, we'll see.
Well, we should talk about that another time. That is definitely a dangerous situation brewing there.
Flashpoint possibilities. We have talked about that and will again. Weibo, mm-hmm. the Chinese Twitter. It's interesting, Damien, you mentioned it. I'm looking here at a photo that the Chinese flashed around of the big party meeting last week. And outside the doors, or the sort of entrance to the Great Hall of the People there, an enormous traffic jam of beautiful, gleaming black Audis, automobiles, the preferred ride of Chinese authorities carrying party Congress delegates as they attempt to, I guess they're exiting here. But what a picture when it comes to issues of equity and power, all these black Audis trying to make their way from the Great Hall of the People. You two are great to be with us today. Damien Ma with the Eurasia Group in Washington. Thank you, Damien.
Thank you.
Susan Shirk at the University of California, San Diego. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This is On Point.